We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back, we're dads on the air.
Good morning, and we're back. Ray Linton here with Dads on the Air again. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning, Ray. Yes, I'm back too.
We're almost home alone this morning, mate.
Well, mate, there's only you and me.
It's just you and me.
Well, let's hope we're not alone. Let's hope there's a few billion trillion people out there actually listening to all of this.
You've got to hope, don't you?
Well, mate, when I get out of bed at 5:30, 6 o'clock on a Tuesday morning to come in here and do this bloody program, I do it with the firm belief that somebody better bloody well be listening.
Yeah, well, Bill Cable's not here today, so...
No, we gave Bill the morning off.
We did.
We did.
And Phil York's on holidays.
Yeah, yep, we've given Phil the morning off, so there's just you and me, really. So it's going to be a huge program.
Yeah, with a bit of luck.
Yeah.
we're flying by the seat of our pants today, folks. Yeah,
another seat of our pants, Lenten Purdy operation here.
Now, Ian, you've just, mate, while I was sitting here and the promo was going on, you were just going off about the ADHD story you got there.
Oh, mate, this is huge. I mean, this is one of my pet whinges. ADHD review as US expert faces inquiry appeared, I think, in, I've ripped it out of the paper. I think it was actually The Australian. Sue Dunleavy, anyway, she's written, Australia's ADHD guidelines are being redeveloped as a US psychiatrist whose work is heavily cited in existing draft guidelines has been sanctioned by Harvard University for violating conflict of interest rules.
Mm.
Now, this is the whole story, because these people, in my opinion, ADHD, we all know what that is, attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder. It's one of these new modern personality disorders that they've, as far as I'm concerned, okay, this is only my opinion, all right, so I will divorce all the rest of Dads on the Air from this. This is my personal rant and rave, so rock and pop, if you're listening, you don't have to feel personally responsible for what I'm about to say. But look, really... You know, this ADHD, I personally believe it was invented by drug pushers from the pharmaceutical industry to push drugs. They're pushing speed on kids. ADHD, they treat it with dexamphetamine or Ritalin, both of which are amphetamines, which is speed. Different variations on the chemical gives you also ecstasy, or all of these nasty branches of the psychotropic chemical factor. Of dollars they received from drugs firms. Now, we're not talking small. These people who are key people in this situation have been bribed millions of dollars. We've got it here in black and white. Millions of dollars. It's not just they were taken to lunch and given a few free notepads like all the doctors and stuff get from the drug companies. They were given... Let me read that again. Harvard University, after allegedly failing to report to the university millions of dollars they received from drug firms, Australia's National Health and Medical Council held off approving the draft guidelines for attention deficit hyperactivity. Now, let me go on with the art. There's more here, you know. The National Health and Medical Research Council said yesterday it could not yet assess being paid to him by the vested interests of the pharmaceutical industry, who basically just want to push drugs on our kids. What's the difference between these people in their high offices and their, you know, in their Learjets and their suits, these respectable business people? What's the difference between them pushing drugs and some scum heroin dealer in the alley flogging a stick of marijuana or something to them as they live? What's the bloody difference,
I
ask?
Absolutely.
There's no difference.
It leads to a culture of drug use and you know, in the society we live in today.
Well, I mean, we have a culture of drug use.
It's no wonder we can't beat or win the drug war when we're breeding a generation of kids who think, you know, it's okay just to take a pill every time you want to feel better.
But, I mean, even the word drug, I mean, the fact that we have, on one hand, we have these drugs, we have their medical things that doctors prescribe you, their, you know, miracle cures for cancer, you know, that's a drug. Then on the other hand, a drug is something that a junkie in the alley takes, you know, that that you OD on, that you know, turns you into a prostitute and a thief. And, you know, we've got this totally schizophrenic that the word is drug. Yeah. I mean, how can a drug be this miracle thing on one hand and this complete and utter social disaster on the other? We've got to – maybe we need to have a different word for illicit drugs as opposed to pharmaceutical – medical drugs.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, the whole thing, it just sends so much mixed message to children.
And if we're going to address the issue of hyperactivity and attention deficit disorder and they go hand in hand, then we need some behavioural plans behind it. You know, I'm in the industry. I look around. I've had it in my family. Go and find a specialist book on to give parents tips on how to manage hyperactive behaviour.
Look, a lot of it comes down to something as basic as diet. You know, don't feed them so much sugar. Yep. Don't let them eat all that process. Don't go to pizza.
And we don't go, you know, I don't see the industry going through those step by step. The diagnostic process is expensive. In order to do it properly, we're talking about MRI scans at the top end. They're not all that intrusive, but they are expensive. And it seems to me we're happy to just throw a pill at it. Perhaps the pill's not as expensive as proper diagnostic assessment. I don't know, but it just seems to me that they're too quick to make the diagnosis, too quick to blame ADD.
Yeah, inconvenient children.
Yeah.
You know, what drug about a diagnosis of being an inconvenient child?
Yeah. You know, for those that have hyperactivity disorder and attention deficit that are at an extreme end may well need a layer of medication.
But you're talking a minuscule percentage.
Absolute last resort. Yeah. Behavioural methods. Parents need assistance.
Less than 1%. Yeah.
Communication becomes acute with children who have hyperactivity. Discipline becomes acute. Techniques need to be applied that contain acute skills, and we need to be skilling parents up. Just look across the debate, the conversation that goes on in the public domain. How do we know, you know, I mean, I've got one here about breast milk and the effect of painkillers on children. I mean, there's something in the paper almost every day that's contrary to something that was in the paper yesterday about the way we feed, raise, drug, sorts of things around our kids.
That's right. What was wisdom last year now is foolishness.
How do ordinary
exposed
people?
As foolishness.
Exactly. How do ordinary people in the street keep up with this crap?
Navigate the minefield of misinformation.
We have, you know, our doctors, our GPs are highly considered, highly trusted. They are the most trusted profession in our society. And yet they've led us down the garden path for the last 30 years with an overuse of.
Well, they've been led down the garden path.
No.
You know,
not at all.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Antibiotics. Yeah. You know, every medical profession and his dog knew 30 years ago that if we kept using antibiotics at the rate we were using them, we were going to run out of their effectivity. And they just weren't going to be effective in the community. And we're almost there.
Well, we produce super germs. We've got germs that
that
no antibiotic can do anything about. They're resistant.
Because we have GPs who are too lazy, really, to have a difficult conversation with their clients who come in and say, I've got a flu, I need an antibiotic, make me feel better. You know, it's just insanity.
Well, I mean, we're going to turn this into you can look at the way that the medical profession, I mean, as soon as they get out of medical school, they go into hospital and then they're on like 30-hour shifts.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they are pretty much worked to death in the first couple of years of being a doctor in a hospital. Any conscience or any thought or any higher, you know, a lack of sleep basically destroys your higher functioning, destroys your compassion, destroys your ability to reason. If you don't get enough sleep, I mean, it seems to me this is what they used to do to torture people. And this is what we do to all of our doctors. As soon as they get out of the week, they get an internship with a hospital and they're expected to work ridiculous hours.
Especially surgeons.
Yeah.
Ridiculous hours. And, you know, I mean, this is the most highly regulated industry in our community. And yet.
And one of the most expensive as well.
And we spend more money on it. You know, like the amount of money we spend in medical research, in drug subsidisation, you know, right in hospitals, right across the sector. This is an expensive and highly regulated industry. And yet, for near on 40-odd years, we've had this overuse of antibiotics in our system, overprescription of a whole range of drugs across the sector. It's just I don't get it.
And well, now these ADHD drugs. I mean, you know, okay, the other drugs, but I mean, this is, you know, pushing drugs on our kids.
This is
a whole new level of it, as far as I'm concerned.
It's been around long enough. ADHD is an issue. It's been around long enough. Ritalin and other interventions, as drug interventions, have been around long enough, and yet the research to show us their affectivity is hard to find.
Exactly.
If there's any there at all, it's hard to find.
Exactly.
Throw a temporary
solution. The kid might be better for a couple of years, but then he comes back with worse problems.
Throw a pill at it, wait for the kid to grow up, and then he's the criminal justice system's problem, not ours. Yeah. Is the way that we approach it for mine. So, yeah, terrible situation. And just to move on, did you see the story on 60 Minutes Sunday night about the guy who murdered his three-year-old daughter?
No, I saved myself having to deal with that one.
Mm. Horrible story. A young mum.
Sounds horrible.
28 AVO breaches, and police failed to act to put him in jail. 28 breaches of an AVO. I found that just unbelievable.
I know, it's incredible, isn't it? You know, it seems like the situations where these legal devices would be of some use, they're not used, and where they're basically just a hindrance, that, you know, they seem to be used, you know, excessively.
And my point
seems to have it all wrong.
This is my point in raising it. We hear so much flack from the other side around the voice that says women, people don't make up stories about, or to get AVOs to manage their way through family law proceedings, or for whatever reason, that they're real and they're needed in the domestic violence industry. They don't work in the domestic violence industry. If you listen to this story, this was a woman who was in severe trouble, who had a partner who was hell-bent on making her life miserable because he left, a control freak.
Yep.
He had breached the AVO 28 times and he was still walking the streets. This is a policing issue. In perhaps a particular police station or a particular local area command where there's some attitude, but
demonstrates. And now the child's dead.
A three-year-old. You know, he went very close to murdering her on the phone so that the mother could listen.
Oh, God.
An absolutely despicable story, a despicable human being. The only saving grace that came out of it was he will spend the rest of his living days in a prison, which was exactly what he deserved to get.
Yeah, exactly.
And too often in these cases we hear that they get out on parole or some other thing. This guy will spend the rest of his living days in jail where he deserves to be. But where there is a severe case of DV, where there's a demonstrated history where a young mum has done everything right and felt that the violence was always towards her, not towards the child, and to her credit, continued to attempt to do the minimum she had to do just to maintain her daughter's relationships. These are tricky relationships to navigate.
Oh, absolutely.
He called in on an afternoon when caught her off guard. Said he was just taking the child to the shop to buy her an ice cream and bring her back in 5-10 minutes. And within an hour and a half, 2 hours, he'd taken her life, and he rang her straight back and told her straight off, killed her. And, horrible story. Again, Channel 9, 60-minute show. You know, it always disturbs me that media like to highlight the fact that this is another father who's taken the life of a child. No recognition of the fact that the numbers are relatively even. Yes, they trend one way or the other from time to time. This is a very small number of people take their children's lives.
Yeah.
It's a low crime rate, but it is committed by both men and women alike, both mothers and fathers alike.
Yeah.
And whenever it happens and whoever does it, it's a despicable crime. And We're blessed that he's been taken off the streets and he won't harm anybody else.
I think we better go to a track, Ray. On the basis of that lot, we'll be back in a moment.
My bed no more, you can't ride in my car. I won't let you good for me, baby. It's never gonna get that far. I'm gonna send you back to where grandfather hell it was you came. And then I'm gonna more, you can't admit the love to me. I hope don't be up there no more, it's the way it's gonna be. I should've left you, baby, back in that last town. This time to fool you made me, girl, I'll never live it down. Girl, it ain't no fun no more, I don't know what to say. Your honeymoon is over, baby, it's never gonna be.
Meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Yeah, and we're back again. We'll continue the theme. The young mother who was killed in Melbourne last week by a young 14-year-old with a knife in a knife attack. And another horrible story last week, Ian.
Yeah, look, I've got the article here. Actually, it was yesterday, I think. It happened. Pia Ackerman has written in The Australian, teen boy charged with egg stabbing. A 14-year-old boy charged with killing a mother of three after egging her house has been released on bail after a court heard the fatal stabbing was triggered by a very minor clash between rival groups of teenaged boys. Rossa McCurry, who is a 40-year-old mother of three, was at home with her family on Sunday night in Melbourne's northern suburbs when the property was egged by a group of boys around 8 p.m. She and her husband, identified as Pat, went outside to investigate and pursued the boys in their car, taking their 11-year-old daughter with them. A homicide detective investigating the case yesterday told a children's court Mrs. McCurry died from a single stab wound when she encountered the accused boy, who cannot be identified, a few blocks from her house.
He's out on bail.
He's 14.
Yeah. Unbelievable. How do you get charged with manslaughter for something like that? I thought
that's murder, isn't it?
Isn't
you pull out a knife and you kill someone, isn't that murder?
Yeah.
And you'd think so. Cold blooded. Self defense. What did she have a knife?
Yeah.
What was she trying to do to him? Hold him until the police came or something.
If we can't produce 14-year-old kids in this society who know the difference between stabbing somebody and killing them and copping a bit of flack for throwing an egg at a house, then we're in trouble. I mean, just
this 14-year-old lives with his father and brother in nearby Bundoora, wherever that is. The police did not oppose his bail. They were saying they were satisfied that there was little risk of further violence.
Mm.
Well, they took the knife off him. Couldn't he go to the drawer and get another knife?
Little risk of further violence. He's taken a young woman's life, a mother, family, children. I don't get it. And, you know, I'm not sure if we have the same problem with knife crime in Sydney, but this knife crime has in and juveniles has been a big issue in Melbourne. They've passed new legislation. Police have new powers in Melbourne to search young people and seize knives. So
good. Great.
Whether we have that issue in New South Wales or in Sydney or not, I'm not sure. But, gee, how do we teach our children that line in the sand? I mean, it wouldn't matter what the, maybe it wasn't wise to pursue them, but.
Well, I don't think it was wise of the father to take his wife and his 11-year-old daughter to go in pursuit. I mean, especially his 11-year-old daughter, I mean, what's she except vulnerability, I mean, these kids were obviously, they're not prepared to respond to authority. They were there to attack. They were there to cause problems. I mean.
Well, I guess that's true, but.
Why go with an 11-year-old girl?
I guess that's true, but, we were talking about this not that long ago, Ian. Our community is not involved anymore. When these are neighbours, these are people who live in the same area.
Yeah, I mean, people live from down the road, yeah.
We should be able to follow the kid down the road and go and have a chat to his dad and say, hey, look, they're throwing eggs at the house. Can we fix this?
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the things that we complain about in our community that, and from my view, when I was a young person growing up, I know the community played a part in parenting me, because if I threw an egg, or even thought about throwing an egg at somebody's house, and I did,
yeah.
and so did most of my friends, we played up.
Yeah, we used to break windows. That's what we used to do, go and throw a stone through the window. My poor dad, he used to have to go around in the weekend and fix all the windows that his bloody sons had smashed. Me and my brother. Shocking.
Yeah. We used to blow up letterboxes, and we used to throw eggs at people's houses. I mean, we did all the stupid things that 14-year-olds do.
Yeah.
But
you didn't have a knife.
I didn't kill anybody when they confronted me. I copped it on the chin.
Yeah. You took your hiding and your whatever it was that you got dished out.
Where does this attitude amongst our young people today come from?
But it's not new, Ray. It's not saying this is not that old. Been cases like this, for a long – I mean, kids have stabbed, adults. I mean, it's not like this is the first time it's ever happened.
No.
It's all very well to blame it on the 21st century and the breakdown of family and stuff. Yeah, but
– I don't know that it's – and I know it's not new, and I know it's not the first one, but in generational senses, it's not that old either. Look, there were gangs around, and violence between men, especially on the street, was about when I was growing up, but – there was a line in the sand. It was one-on-one stuff. The world's changed dramatically. And to start with, how do 14-year-olds get out of the house with knives in their pocket? How do they carry them around the streets? Well, are they hiding them from their parents? Where does this attitude come from that we're okay to defend ourselves from any attack in this way? I'd be honest with you, I don't get it. And it's a catch-22 for me. The more these kids that play these games, these kids that behave this way are terrorists. They're urban terrorists.
Yeah, they are. Terrorism. That's exactly what
exactly.
It is.
They're about with knives in their pocket. They're throwing and eggs, and they're doing stuff just to egg the community on. The minute somebody confronts them, they pull weapons. And it feeds into our psyche. And now we have a generation of people. Perhaps this is the second or third generation of people who are just not prepared to confront kids in the street anymore. And they've got free rein. Everybody's afraid of them. We're not afraid of one youth anymore. Now we're afraid of all of them, because they all have a potential to have a knife in their pocket. And the end result is that we've retreated. We've retreated from our streets. And these kids, you walk around Liverpool after 10 or 11 o'clock at night. I mean, the kids that were involved in that vicious beating in Liverpool were in court last week. And, some of the excuse for that, again, that was, kicking a guy in the head who's lying on the ground. It was vicious. Some of the excuse that was given for that sort of behaviour. I mean, I'm not one to be punishing two-year-olds, and I'm more than happy that young kids are not all that responsible for minor crime. But when it comes to taking a life, how this kid gets out on bail just sends a signal to me that he's not going to be in jail for life for long anyway when he does get convicted. And as far as I'm concerned, at 14, if you don't know that you can't pull a knife out of your pocket
and
take somebody's life over being confronted about throwing eggs at a house, then you deserve to be in an adult prison, not a child prison, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, that's just basic stuff. It's basic humanity. And if we've lost that, and if we've lost the edge to be able to demonstrate that principle to our community, that it's just not okay to be...
I don't have to say we've lost it. There's always been sections of the community that never had it.
I guess that's true.
There's always been the fringe. Yeah. There, always.
Yeah. And I guess there always will.
Yeah. But it just seems like those numbers of people on the fringe who don't understand basic right and wrong seem to be growing.
Yes.
And this type of crime seems to be on the increase.
It does.
It seems to be. I don't know if we're just paranoid old men going, lived in the middle of road and rolled up newspaper raid, 84 of us.
No, the crime stats demonstrate that this is a crime that is on the increase and has been on the increase for, probably 20 or 30 years. And the problem with it is that the community withdraws. Every time we read something about this, you're driving down the street in your car and you have a minor accident and your heart's beating when you get out of the car.
You're going to run into some maniac with a knife who's going to scream at you and throw a road rage on you. And
yeah. You bump into somebody. You see kids in the street doing stuff they shouldn't be doing. You think, will I go and say something as an adult? Or will they have knives in their pockets? And the consequence of this happening as often as it does and hearing more about it is that community withdraws. And the
consequence for this man is he's lost his wife.
It's horrible.
And the girl's lost her mother. I mean...
Yeah. And before their eyes, to see that happen before their eyes, the trauma
on the
of that.
Street, in front of everybody, in the open,
And here's a community now. Here's a small community now, a neighbourhood community that's in turmoil and who will carry the trauma of that event for some time to come in their neighbourhood. And as far as I'm concerned, that type of crime, it certainly shouldn't be walking the streets. I just don't believe that one could expect after being convicted that one would be not getting a custodial sentence for taking someone's life in that circumstance.
Yeah, well, justice must be seen to be done.
Straight back into jail.
Yeah, he should be in jail. That 14-year-old should not have been released on bail.
Why he would be charged with manslaughter rather than murder in that situation has got me beat. Perhaps it's the difference between the intent to take one's life and a reactive crime in an argument. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
It's got me beat.
The facts are there's a woman dead and there's a 14-year-old with a knife and it's dripping blood and, it's pretty much an open and shut case, you'd think, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
He killed her.
Yeah.
She, whatever she did, say, hey, you're egging my house. He pulled out a knife, he stabbed her, she's dead. I mean, those are the facts.
And by the time it gets through the children's court, we won't hear anything of it. We won't even know what's happened to this young man.
You think not? A lot of these cases, they do follow them through.
Sometimes, but it'll be, it'll be page 20.
Well.
Kid gets 18 months for manslaughter, and it'll be that far into the distant future with the clog up. The children's courts are clogged there.
And no one will put it together that it was this particular case that shocked the nation pretty much.
Nor care.
On this day. And you don't put that together and we've moved on.
Exactly.
And there's another 10 murdered children.
Between now and then. Exactly
to
right.
To worry about.
Yep. And again, I've had occasion to be in the city the last couple of weeks on a Friday morning, Ian. And at 5:30, 5:45 in the morning, the remnants of the young people.
Staggering home from the late night parties.
They're not going home. They're not going home. They're still out partying at 6:30 in the morning, still causing trouble, still screaming out to people, still throwing stuff across the street.
Yeah, but that's always been the case. I mean, I used to drive taxis in the 80s, and, the difference between the day, because you'd start at 3 in the afternoon and work to 3 in the morning, and, the type of person around 10, 11 o'clock, you just go for it. Was like two completely different species.
Yes.
The day people who are all regular, they dress a certain way, they all got a job, and they talk about certain things and blah. And then you get these night people who are completely different. They don't tend to be employed. They tend to be working on, in the fringe somewhere and in some sort of shady industry doing, who knows what. And the conversations that were completely different.
Mm.
Just two completely different species,
the
night people and the day people.
Absolutely. And like I say, you see, as you're driving up George Street, Sydney at, 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, you see the remnants still there.
What are you doing driving up the street at that time in the morning? Well, Ray, I thought you were a respectable gentleman.
I am, but I've been out and about, and the court support work that we're doing with Dads in Distress at the moment has taken a it's taken off. We've got some assistance from the Toongabby Legal Centre. We've been doing some training over there around court support processes. It seems that the growth of self-represented litigation in family law has now spread to local courts and district courts.
Good, good. I think we've got to get the lawyers out of the equation. Really, that, you know, there's just too much money being made out of too much misery.
Well, you know, I finished some training on the week last Saturday week and with the Toongabby Legal Centre, and there was a district court judge there, and we had a cup of coffee and a quiet chat, and he wasn't aware of the significant growth in self-represented litigation in family law over the last 20 years, especially, you know, in 16 years. In 1995, less than 4% of all applicants were self-represented in family law. And that was about 25,000 applications around the whole nation a year. By 2000, it was bordering on 50%, and they were at almost 100,000 applications a year.
Wow.
Now, that's changed again, but above 65% of people self-representing in family law circles today.
Well, that's the only way you're going to get properly represented, in my opinion. I mean, some lawyers just going to, you know, a nod and a wink to a judge. They know each other, play golf together, you know, gives them that look, yeah, this one's no good sort of thing, and you're gone. I mean, you're the only person who can really represent yourself. You need to stand up there and show the court that you are a decent, you know, cohesive human being who can present a proper case, who is capable of looking after children.
Well, and I think it's been a significant part of the change in family law over the last 14 or 15 years because, you know, when you sit in the back of the courts day in, day out, and you hear solicitors and barristers put cases to judges, you hear this roteness about it, and there's something very similar about, you know, if you hear 10 submissions from one solicitor or barrister, yes, there's something familiar about all of them.
Yeah, no, they just photocopy the form and
templates,
and change the name at the top and a couple of the factual details and the dates, and it's basically the same thing. Yeah, it's
particular
production line.
It is, and particular solicitors and barristers have particular best interests of the child issues that they focus on, and they say things in very similar ways. What's changed in the last 15, 16 years in family law is that mums and dads have been standing at the bar table. They bring their emotions with them. They cry.
Yeah.
They get sad, and they show those emotions. And judges have started to realise that we're real people, that we do have feelings, that we do care about our children, I think especially for men, because in the early part of the 90s, men basically didn't go to family court unless they had a lot of money. So it was just a particular type of bloke who was going there, and he was always represented. You know, the tough end is for a judge who's got to look a real father or a real mother in the eye and say, this is what I'm going to do.
You're never going to see your kids again.
Or you're only going to see them this often, or no, you can't ring them on Wednesday nights, or no, you can't have them on school holidays, or you can't take them on that holiday to New Zealand or wherever. I think the decision makers have had a different view of the passion that parents have for their children over the last 16 years because they've been able to talk to them rather than talking to these cardboard cutout solicitors that present. And, you know, certainly there are good and bad in every profession, but family law, you know, family law is an ugly industry at that level. And it was interesting. I said to the district court judge, I wonder what it is that's contributing to this growth of self-represented litigation across the law. I wonder if it's got something to do with the $450, $500 an hour that the average good solicitor is charging.
Yeah,
it's an incredible amount of money.
It's an absolute rip-off. It's a rort.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I went to law school. I decided back in 1976 that practicing the law was immoral, and I'm not doing it. You know,
well, it's an interesting profession, and the growth of the profession, people would be surprised to know that the law is practiced today in a way that's only been practiced for about the last 100 or so years. That this is relatively new in history's page, the way we practice and the way lawyers present all of our stuff in courts. Is relatively new. It's only been around for about 100 years. So we're doing a lot more court support work, and that's got me into the city a couple of times last week in the very early hours of the morning.
Right, so getting back to the original question, that little rant and rave, so that's why you're parading around, gallivanting around the streets at the wee hours of the morning.
And I must admit, at 56, you know, when you have to get out of the car, you sort of look left and right to see who's about. You know, that's the nature of our society
today. You didn't used to do that when you were 26?
No. No, as a matter of fact, it hasn't been that long that it's been in my mind that, you know, you've just got to be a little more careful today when you're out, especially when it's out of daytime hours, you know, early in the morning, late at night, on a train. I feel, you know, perhaps I'm just getting old, but I feel a lot more vulnerable in the world today than I ever did in my life. I've generally been a guy who's felt pretty safe and travelled on public transport late at night, worked in the city, travelled home late at night, used to catch the last bus home, the last train home, have a bit of fun on it. There'd be somebody around who was a bit inebriated, maybe somebody around with a guitar. You know, used to have a lot of fun on the trains late at night with the fun people who were coming home from the city. They don't come home anymore. They stay in there and fight all night. They're still around bleeding.
Use the guitar as a weapon.
They're still around bleeding in the earliest hour of the morning. We'll go to a break. Yeah, we're back. And just quickly, Ian, I just wanted to mention the new laws on Muslim women who wear the hijab, the full face cover. And I don't know if you noticed that they've passed the legislation now that It gives a policeman the authority to say, I need to see your face.
Yeah.
And requires a person to show their face.
I think that's a bloody good idea. I'm really.
I'm a bit shocked that we needed to go that far, you know, because, I mean...
Well, it's only because it's a religious thing. If there was no religious connotation to it, it would be a no-brainer. It would never have got off the ground in the beginning.
But don't you think it's interesting that on the roadside, when you've committed an offence and a police officer pulls you up, he wants to verify your driver's licence with the person who's driving the car.
But if you're wearing a burqa when you have your driver's licence photograph taken...
You wouldn't get a driver's licence.
And what if you're wearing a different burqa on the day that you had the photo taken to the one that you're wearing on the day when you need
you can't
to be identified?
You can't wear it when you take your photo for your driver's licence. So if you want to wear it and claim religious privilege, you can't have a driver's licence. You've got to lift the veil.
And that's fair enough because, I mean, these radical serious Muslims, like in Saudi Arabia, women aren't allowed to drive anyway.
That's right.
I mean, so...
So they need driver's licences. So they don't have...
They don't need them, yeah. What about passports? What if they need a passport?
I mean, if you walk into the immigration department and say, I want a passport, I want a visa to go to China or somewhere else, what do they do when they take your photo?
I mean... But hang on... Can a bloke wear a burqa? I mean, isn't this a completely sexist thing? I mean, what about a bloke wearing a burqa? Can we get a bloke burqa?
No.
So that men can walk away. We should be able to hide our face too?
We should be able to.
If I don't want women perving at my face because it's so sexy that they can't control themselves.
You certainly could.
I should have been covered in concrete from birth. I'm so sexy.
You should get out onto a building site on a hot day, mate. The blokes wear all sorts of things to cover their faces up, poking out from under their sunnies and all sorts of stuff. Look. No, it from a religious perspective. I mean, this stuff comes from the Old Testament. Islam and Christianity share parts of the Old Testament.
Yep.
We see nuns wear this sort of stuff, a little bit different, but it comes from the same parts of the Bible. Certainly the nuns in our modern communities don't wear the full hijab, the full face cover, but certainly in past we've seen nuns in Christian communities wear them. No,
so you think that makes it okay because Christians
have done
it?
Christians
have done it.
I don't get that it becomes an issue. I mean, obviously it's not an issue when we get a driver's license, when we get a bank account, when we get a passport or a visa. But it is because we want something perhaps. And then when a policeman pulls us up on the side of the road and says, well, I need to identify you, all of a sudden it becomes a problem. I don't get that. I don't get that. If we were serious and it was all that it's said to be about showing the face in that circumstance, then they wouldn't have driver's licences because they wouldn't be able to lift the veil to get the photo taken. They wouldn't have passports because they wouldn't be able to lift the veil to have the photo taken. So it seems like there's two applications of the religion. You know, when I want something, then it's okay to lift the veil and be identified. But when a policeman... pulls me up on the side of the road.
And it's not in my interest.
I'm not going
to cling to my religious privilege at all costs.
Then it's, exactly. It's going to be a sin to show you my face. I don't get the double standard. So, I think it's been a story that just makes the whole legal profession, how that woman got away with her crime.
I mean, but the whole pretext of the whole thing is basically saying that men cannot control themselves, that if a man looks upon a beautiful woman, he can't be trusted to behave like a gentleman, that he is likely to turn into a rutting goat and perform some disgusting, heinous act of sexual malfeasance or something.
Because I got to see a female's face. I don't get it. I don't get it.
I
don't take exception to it. Women have got the right to express their religious faith any way they choose. Both in the Christian movement and nuns. I mean, I don't get the idea of getting married to God and going off and living like a hermit to some degree in the Christian movement, in the nun movement. I don't get that either. But people have the freedom to do that, and I don't take away people's right to express their religious views in any way they see fit. However,
well, it's very nice of you, Ray.
We live in a society where we need to be able to identify people. You know, when my kids walk into a public toilet, I want to know that there's only women in there while they're in there.
Yeah.
And yeah. when there's people around wearing that sort of stuff.
Absolutely right.
You just don't know. And I
well, that's a point too, and dressing, you know, changing rooms and gyms and swimming pools and stuff.
Yep.
You know, that's
a variety of places. But, yeah,
exactly. And get somebody, some bloke in there in a burqa.
Yep.
You wouldn't know.
And I can live with a standard if people have a faith and they demonstrate a particular standard. But if that lady's standard had have been held to the way that she says it was, she wouldn't have had a license in the first place because her license had a picture of her face on it.
Yeah, and so she would never have lifted her veil to have the photo taken in the first place.
And it's either okay or it isn't. If it's not okay to lift your veil for a police officer, then it shouldn't be okay to lift your veil for the camera to get your license in the first place. And I just don't get that we had to create special legislation to give police the power to identify a human being driving a car.
Yeah, you know, that's how this, you know, this religion, you know, only in the name of religion.
Yeah.
There's nothing else in our society that could purport to, you know, turn our rights and our laws on their head in the name of religious freedom.
Crazy stuff.
And I mean, religious freedom to cover yourself up and not be seen. I mean, it's a very strange definition of freedom.
It is.
I consider freedom the right to take all my clothes off and run around and squeal and shriek and do what I like as opposed to covering myself up and hide.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a strange reflection of how a person may believe and have faith in what's supposed to be a loving God. But
Islam comes from a completely different culture to what we're used to. You know, I mean, it's a desert culture. You know, from the Middle East. I mean, Christianity is the same. It comes from the same desert culture.
Yeah,
they come from a different culture, a culture that you know, it's not our culture. I mean, I'm not Jewish.
No. And I'm not saying Christianity is any better. Christianity, you know, the Ku Klux Klan were a bunch of Christians, Ian.
Oh, well, look, absolutely. You know,
at the end of the day.
Yeah, there's
maniacs. People had their day.
Yeah, look, there's maniacs of all religions.
They are.
You know.
Yeah. So, I wonder how much we've spent as a community on this particular case alone. The court case that she got away with, the policeman's time on the side of the road, all of the work to get her into court, then the appeal, all the work.
Think how many newspapers we've sold and how much airtime we're getting away with Ray here, you know?
And now
the money comes in.
And now a couple hundred thousand dollars worth of new legislation. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. Look, let's stop wasting our valuable time. Look, on this nonsense.
A good story in it. Well, look, it's all nonsense. Look, nonsense is a good word because that's what it's been about today and it's going to continue. Here's some more stuff from the more nonsense from the Institute of Family Studies. This is in today's Australian. Dads cope as mums suffer. I love this. Women are more likely than men to suffer a decline in relationship satisfaction after the birth of a child as their workload increases and they adopt more traditional gender roles, an Institute of Family Studies report.
Relationship satisfaction. That's how do you define relationship satisfaction? I mean,
well, and could one person be satisfied and another not? I would think if my wife was dissatisfied with our relationship, that it would have some impact on me as well.
Yeah, and also the fact that I mean, this is the relationship. Having the child is the relationship actually coming to fruition. That this is the highest peak of what the relationship can produce. We've produced a child together.
Darling. I wonder if we pay the Institute of Family Studies to do these things. Anyway,
it boggles the brain. Really,
I continue the study into how couples cope with the transition to parenthood finds women's total workload, paid employment, childcare, and housework goes up by 64%.
Oh, these are these bean counters who run around the house with a time in motion, you know, measuring what everybody does and deciding if it's free work or if it's paid work or...
Well, it goes up by 64% after they have a child, but men's workload increases by only 37%.
Well, there you go.
And I would suggest that a large part of that would be men's refusal to breastfeed.
Yeah.
Absolute refusal, you know, miserable... Miserable bastards.
Yeah.
You'd think that at least they'd take their share of that, wouldn't you?
Well, and you think at least half of us would be prepared to go and have the bloody baby for them.
What about having
the actual kid itself?
Well, exactly,
you know?
Right.
Going in there and going through all that carry on.
The transition to parenthood is more disruptive for high income earning women who have high status and well paid jobs, the paper says. However, other research suggests that younger and less educated parents also struggle after having children. The study says preparing parents to cope with the relationship changes after the birth of a child are particularly important if the birth occurs during the first 5 years of marriage. Mate, I wonder how much that cost us.
Yeah.
Lovely piece of research there.
Yeah.
And especially the percentages, 64%. I mean, breastfeeding's an onerous task. I take my hat off to the women of this country.
I take my bra off.
Who do.
To the women who breastfeed, I do.
Take the time to breastfeed. It's an important part of child's development, very important, one I think we probably don't understand enough about. Very important for attachment, very important for immune systems. And I take my hat off to the time and care that women take, but it's something that they can only do. And when we get this sort of crap where we measure the time and motion of people and we imply that men don't shoulder the burden of change like women do, there are some things we just can't do. We just can't do. And I would expect that if my wife's relationship with me changed, then my relationship with her would change as well.
Well, I would say, Ray, you should be prepared. Once you've had the kid, you should be prepared to put the rubbish out twice every night.
Every night.
Twice.
Yeah.
Not just once, like it had been before. You should, okay, we've got a kid now. I'm doubling my workload. I'll put the garbage out twice tonight.
Every night. That's probably
a good
idea.
And I'll put the cat out twice too.
If I had a cat, I would put it out probably three times.
I've got a cat and the bloody thing sleeps in my bed.
Yes.
And anyway. You want to talk about domestic violence, you want to talk about my cat. He's a shocker.
And this is the sort of stuff that comes from the Institute of Family Studies. You would expect that they would be independent of government. And
you'd think they would have enough, you know, serious issues which really need to be looked at. You know, let's look at all these kids running around with knives
And you would think that they would be considering that their research is paid for by the public purse, that they would be conducting credible research with credible numbers about important things that impact the lives of people and lead us somewhere rather than this constant flow of crud that comes out of the joint.
We need more crap in the world.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
There's not enough crap.
And we wonder why parents with all sorts of things going on for their kids are struggling to know what they can and can't do or what they should or shouldn't do and how they resolve some of these. No wonder our kids are in so much trouble. You know, we're being led down the garden path left, right and centre. And even when we're not, we can't see the good stuff because there's so much crap around it.
Well, it's the misinformation that we get shoveled at us through advertising. Yeah. You know, advertising and all of these people who have a product to push who doctor up research and stuff to prove that it does things that it doesn't. You know, this is where all the misinformation comes from, where people have a vested interest in pushing a certain product.
And if we can't trust the Institute of Family Studies.
Well, what product they're pushing a product, the family is the product they're pushing.
Well, maybe a particular type of family is a product, or maybe they're captured by feminists. Certainly it reflects the feminist agenda of this current Labor government.
Well, now we've got the Greens. We need to talk about that too. The Greens took over the Senate yesterday.
They
have the balance of power.
They do. And so, you know, when we could expect that the family violence bill will get safe passage.
It'll race through. It'll romp through.
Both houses. And to some degree, the Senate inquiry, all that did was pave the way for time to be killed while they were waiting for the Greens to take control of the Senate so they can shove
it through.
And it seems like a number of the amendments that were made in the lower house have been reneged upon, and it's back through the lower house now. I'm not sure where the passage of it's at, but certainly you wouldn't expect that there'd be any drama in the Senate now.
So they're redefining violence so that it's more useful in court so that you can stop a father seeing his child, but less useful in the case of that woman who had 28 AVOs and then the bastard took the kid away and murdered it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and in those situations, there's no extra help there.
Exactly.
It's at the soft end.
And the thing that annoys, you know, I'm often criticised because I speak out about AVOs the way that I do, but If you talk to women who are really in domestic violence circumstances where the violence is severe and serious and they are afraid for their safety and afraid for their life and it's real, you'll find that AVOs don't work. They don't go far enough. Those sorts of men who are dedicated on making somebody else's life miserable, and women for that matter, are quite capable. You know, one of the things that happens when you drag control freaks through the law is they learn. They may be control freaks. They may be emotionally troubled, but they still are adults and they're still able to learn. And when you drag them through the courts, they learn how the system works, and there's a fine line between breaching an AVO and not breaching it, and often they learn how to straddle those lines.
Right up to the line, yeah.
Get one foot on the other side of it. And because, you know, to some degree, we have this issue in community where AVOs and their credibility is being questioned, we then have attitudes within policing, or we have situations where they look minor on the surface. And because there's so many of them, we don't act appropriately. If the AVO industry was left for those violent men and women who do exist in our community, who need a layer of restraint around them to stay away from other people, then perhaps the whole system would work better, and perhaps that three-year-old would still be alive, because that man, after 28 breaches, should have been in jail.
Yeah,
I mean, how many times do you have to say to somebody, the person over there doesn't like you, and you need to stay away?
And you have to stay away.
Exactly. Threatening messages, harassing phone calls, all of those things need to be taken more serious. They are, but they're not, because...
No, but it's amazing, because at the other end, you know, where you've got someone who just wants to see his kid, and he gets an AVO taken out on him, and that gets used against him in court. And I mean...
Yeah. This guy had never been anywhere near a family court.
No.
And it stands to reason, too afraid. And often, men in that situation, they aren't often involved in family court proceedings. And yet, we've got a government who's hell-bent on bringing this through. I don't think the legislation's all bad, though, Ian. You know, to some degree, look, there was a time when AVOs were administered on behalf of women only, and not that long ago.
Yep.
And if you walked as a man into a police station and said, I want to make a complaint, if you walked as a man into a... complain about a woman harassing you, if you walked in as a man to a chamber magistrate and asked to take a private information action and run it yourself, there's no way in the world police 10 years ago would have run an AVO application on your behalf, not in a bull's roar. They'd have laughed at you. They'd have laughed at you. And even the chamber magistrates back in the late 90s were not interested in assisting you to put the application up. Now, because of the expansion of the definition of domestic violence, men can get some relief from ADVOs, and more are, and we're finding out more and more the real circumstances of how some women do behave in abusive ways. And it may well be that this bill will give us the same opportunity. You know, I certainly know that the issue of one parent alienating the child from the other has been an issue that for a long time family law has been reluctant to look at, reluctant to acknowledge. Perhaps this definition of domestic violence will give the courts some incentive to look more broadly, because that layer under the new, that layer of alienating a child from the other parent will come under the gambit of domestic violence now. Courts will have to look at it differently.
Okay, yeah, that, I can see it, yeah.
And it may well give, you know, I don't want to be dour, it's going to happen. I choose to live in the real world.
Yeah.
And we can sit around and whinge and moan about the fact that it is. The fact is that I am involved in court support in family law circles. I will be supporting men when the change comes. And the only way that you can do it effectively is to deal with the system that sits in front of you. And there's always a silver lining in most clouds, so it may well be that it won't be good for everybody, but it may well give some people who are at that level where they have children who are being alienated from them some relief to go back into the courts and talk about it and get some relief. We'll take a short break.
For both father and child.
We try to adjust and happy memories are filed.
It's hard to cope with a life full of stress
that's leaving us empty, our emotions a mess.
Despite our separation, our love will not die. With courage and keep us together. Help us to call. Hey, all you children, we don't see your dad. We both need each other to share what we have. Fathers love their children as much as mothers do. We must fight this injustice for me and for you. There will come a time before we're too old.
We'll sit down together, Dad, and the truth will be told.
We'll discover the lies that have kept us apart.
No more.
Sooner or later, the truth we will know.
Hey, all you children, we don't see your dad. We both need each other to share what we have. Fathers love their children as much as mothers do. We must fight this injustice for me and for you. We both need each other to share what we have. Fathers love their children as much as mothers do. We must fight this injustice for me and for you.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Yeah, welcome back, folks. You're here with Ray Lenton and Ian Purdy on the Dads on the Air program.
Absolutely.
And the nonsense continues, Ian.
Yes, on and on we go. Well, this actually isn't nonsense. This is from today's Australian. Deafening silence from Pollies about declining student performance. Ben Jensen has written, two worrying trends are evident in Australian school education. First, the performance of Australian students compared with other countries is declining. The latest results from the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development's Programme for International Student Assessment that assesses 15-year-olds' reading, scientific and mathematical literacy in 65 countries showed Australia was only one of only four countries to have a big decline in students' performance between 2000 and 2009. So we're one of only four countries out of 65. Our students, our literacy, our students are declining, basically. Performance is declining. The disadvantage this creates for our children is magnified by the continued rise in the performance of education systems in East Asia. 15-year-old students in Shanghai now perform at a level equivalent to about 1 year above the performance of 15-year-olds in Australia in reading literacy and the equivalent of about 2 years in mathematics.
Wow.
That is significant. That is huge.
Do they propagate any sort of reason for why this is happening, Ian?
Well, we'll get on to that. That's the first concern, okay, that we are going backwards. The second concern is that there has been no response to these results in the 6 months since their release. Our political leaders do not take this problem seriously. It is difficult to determine which is worse, the declining performance of our students or the lack of response to it. debate about education in Australia is too narrow. In Queensland, the media focus on the release of the PISA results was on the greater performance of its students compared with New South Wales. In fact, the performance of students in Queensland went slightly backwards between 2000 and 2009, but the performance of New South Wales students fell further back. So they Queensland compared themselves to New South Wales.
And they were doing okay.
Or saying that, well, New South Wales were doing worse, that's all. They're saying we're doing well because we're not as bad as New South Wales.
Yeah,
you know, this is shocking. Well, let me, despite the political rumor, let me see if I can find a reason for it. Well, why are our lack of men in teaching has got to be one reason.
You'd have to think so.
You'd have to.
The preciousness of the industry. You know, you talk about a debate. I think the debate's atrocious. You know, when Julia Gillard put the school's website up, do you remember the debate?
Yeah. My school debate, and of course all the teachers all jumped up and down and screamed.
Teachers, no, principals.
Yeah, no, we don't want to be rated. You can't do that. It's disadvantaging.
Did you get any of that?
I thought that was a whole bunch of teachers and headmasters just being
princesses.
Just being pains in the neck, really. Come on, you care about the kids or you care about yourselves?
Yep.
More interested in themselves and how they look than what they're actually doing for the kids. That's what I thought.
And you know, there was the debate around canes in schools was reignited again last week.
There was more talk about corporal punishment in schools.
I was in a train actually listening to a conversation where people were talking about how they got the cane when they were kids and it didn't hurt them.
What do you think? I got the cane heaps. We used to put little notches in our belt. You know, I got most cane in my fourth form. That was my most prolific year. I was a shocker at school.
Yeah, same here.
I was bad.
Same here. I actually got expelled.
So
yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, look, no, when canes in schools were first taken out, I was the president of a PNC in my children's school at the time, and we had a principal who just would come to every PNC meeting and whinge about the fact that canes were going to be taken out, and it started getting to me. And I said to him one day, mate, it's going to happen. Go and talk to the police and do something about it and stop it, or get with the program because it's going to happen. A year later, he admitted to me that nothing had changed in his school. I wonder if canes are the answer. The issue of behaviour and discipline in schools has been an issue that's been on the table for quite some time. And the only answer as a modern community that we have is to brandish every teacher in the state with its stick so they can walk around the school ground beating kids with it. You know, we're a modern community. I would have thought.
Yeah, but look, we've just had this 14-year-old kid stab a 40-year-old woman to death in the street.
Is a cane going to teach that kid respect?
No, what I think it is, and it's not just cane, it comes back to the whole corporal punishment thing, smacking kids. I mean, we've made it, you're not allowed to smack your kids. I think this is wrong. I think what this does is, what happens when you smack a kid or you cane a kid is you present to them very serious barriers that within which their behaviour is acceptable and outside of which their behaviour is unacceptable, and there will be painful consequences for them. That's what corporal punishment does. It shows them where the line is, and it lets them know that there will be physical, actual consequences if they cross that line. Now, this line is actually a line of security, because the child knows that as long as they're on the right side of the line, their behaviour is acceptable. Once they step over that line, their behaviour is not acceptable, and they will be subject to consequences, you know, caning, capital punishment, corporal punishment, whatever, you know, depending on the level of it. What is the problem with these children these days is they don't have any line. They've never had a line drawn. They don't have any safety zone. They're not safe anywhere. There's no line within which they are safe. They are not safe. They are vulnerable. That's why they have to pick up a knife and go out onto the street, because nowhere in their head are they safe. They have never had a boundary put in there where they know on this side of the line, I'm safe, I can behave, and everything will be cool. On that side, consequences. If there's no line, then there's no safety.
Yeah.
I think that certainly makes sense. Is why corporal punishment, I think, especially for boys, is very important. Because boys are physical. We're telling boys, you don't teach boys by talking about things. That's how you teach girls. You teach boys by doing things.
Yeah.
Give them a smack around the ass, they'll learn. They'll learn.
I'm mindful of the effort we put into the national curriculum. And, I wonder if we've got a school environment that's unruly in terms of behaviour and discipline, whether it really matters what the curriculum looks like. And certainly it doesn't seem like it does. I would think the first priority in our schools is to get them to be places where the environment around discipline and behaviour is respectful, and then think about the curriculum. Because while schools, and it's not one school in particular, we have a general endemic problem within our schools, and not in New South Wales or Queensland, right around the country. This is...
Well, we're going backwards compared to kids in Asia and China and Vietnam and Thailand, Cambodia. Those kids are getting a better education. They are getting ahead, and our kids are going backwards.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
That's serious.
I think from the Asian perspective, I think we need to be careful, because often, Asian communities hold education to a different value than we do, and often you find parents standing right behind their children with their fingers in the nub of their back, pushing them through their education.
Well, there's the phenomenon of the tiger mother, the woman who's written this book, the Chinese woman of the tiger mother, and the tiger mother basically disciplines the kid, and the kid gets no free time, and their whole life is divided up into a big curriculum, and, there's no time for the kid to be a kid.
And if you look around the Asian world... where's the advantage for the Asian communities? Because
An advantage if you're a Chinese totalitarian system, like the political system they've got over there. You bring up conformists.
Well, I guess that's true.
Whereas in Australia, that's not going to work, because we don't have a totalitarian system, and you need a little bit of ambition and a little bit of initiative to get ahead.
True.
In a capitalist society.
But they haven't taken over the rich list yet. So I suggest that for a lot of those kids who are pushed through primary school with their parents' finger firmly in the nub of their back, fall over after it's over and make their own way. They take time out. That in the world, even though, many Asian communities have had good outcomes in academic performance for a significant period of time in the past, and yet we don't see those communities repeating that performance in the early part of their adult working lives. They've not taken over the rich list. You look around, they're not at the top end of all of the professions. So I think there's probably some boundaries there between our community and theirs that we need to find a balance in. But again, if we have an environment that's conducive to learning, that is respectful, where the issues of behaviour and discipline are dealt with appropriately, then we've got a learning environment. I would suggest right now we haven't got one. And, the leaders of our communities are hell-bent on getting the states together and all of the big thinkers together to rewrite the curriculum. We've done all of this work over the last couple of years around the curriculum, the content in schools. Well, you could have the best content in the universe there. If the environment is not conducive to learning, if we haven't got children in respectful relationships with good behaviour in the playground and in the... We've still got schools with 200, 300, 400 students on lunch breaks for 45 minutes with one teacher in the playground looking after that many kids. It's insane.
Yeah, no, that's
insane.
A lack of funding.
And we wonder why that line's not being drawn in the sand for our children. It's a lack of workplace effort. This has been an issue since time immemorial. It's always been the way, and nothing's changed. Parents come out and talk about the problems that they have with bullying and other issues in the school and in the playground, in the classroom and in the playground. Teachers are coming out talking about it. Principals are coming out talking about it. And yet we've still got an industry of teachers who haven't been able to come back together with their employers, our governments, and come up with flexible arrangements. We've got older people about, older men who could come in and work as volunteers in the school. We've had an army of volunteers in the schools since Adam was in short pants soon. We would not have the education standards that we have today if it wasn't for the army of mothers generally, as volunteers who've worked in the schools for generations.
Yep, absolutely.
Armies
yep.
of them.
Yep.
And yet we haven't looked at that resource and gone, well, let's expand that into the discipline area. Why haven't we got granddads in playgrounds on playground duty instead of one teacher? How does one teacher control 300 or 400 students? It's insanity.
Don't. Yeah, they don't.
Exactly right. And we wonder why we're at the place. Forget the curriculum. You know, that's the second step. The first step.
But then that's unpaid work. You know, then they're going to have to start paying people to do it. I mean, this is we're not a community, Ray. We're a market.
And
unless someone's getting a dollar, nothing happens.
That's right. But, well, you know, grandparents are out there, and, you know, we've got a generation of grandparents in this country who care. We've got a generation of grandparents who are caring for their grandkids and want to care for their grandkids and who are not complaining about it. We should be recognising that effort and applauding that effort.
Harnessing it.
And harnessing
Seeing it as a resource.
Because older people are not useless, they're just older. And even when they retire, they're still looking for stuff to do. You know, people don't retire to go and sit on the couch and watch, you know, Everybody Loves Raymond.
Absolutely. Well, if you do that, then you're just basically waiting to die.
You die.
You just die. Yeah.
You do.
You need to keep active. You need to keep your mind
active.
People
want to be active. They might not want to work. They might not require an income to do some of this work. And I would suggest that with the quality of grandparents that we have at our disposal, that they would be more than keen to take up a role as a mentor, as a senior person.
Sure, to get involved in the lives of their grandchildren. A lot of them have been excluded through family breakup and various other
things. Their communities.
Yep.
And and we could harness that. But at least to be thinking, you know, what we've not had one summit, we've not had a federal politician come out and talk collectively about the issue of bullying. This is a complex issue. It's not an easy one to fix. It's not cut and dried. It's not just about one kid picking on another often. It's about a broader dynamic in many, many circumstances. We've been talking about bullying in the playground for a long, long time, and we've done nothing. We've got nowhere. Maybe we've had isolated successes here and there, but across our community, we've not found a way to contain and bring it back to an acceptable level so people are being treated or are at school in respectful relationships. And that's the key for me. I don't think
respectful relationships really is the key.
It doesn't matter what you teach kids. If you're in an environment of fear and distrust and where there's no discipline, well, it's throwing a coin in the air. Some are going to learn and some aren't. And of course you're going to get these outcomes. Forget the curriculum. We need environments that are safe. We need environments that are respectful, that have appropriate levels of discipline so that we can expect good behaviour.
But also comes down to the quality of the teachers.
Absolutely.
The teachers themselves, and we're not paying them enough. You know, I mean,
maybe that's why they're so precious. I mean, the website, I just never got any of the argument about the website.
Yeah,
they don't want to be assessed. They don't want to be accountable.
Yeah.
It's their own world. You know, I get often the impression that if there were no students and parents around the school, teachers' jobs would be a lot easier.
They'd be a lot happier.
And everybody'd be a lot happier. Yeah. I mean, that's what the core of it's about. And it's not about the education. You know, there are plenty of stories in the analogues of history of rich people, of highly successful and productive people who've come from troubled backgrounds where they've had absolutely no education. A great education is not the be-all and end-all to a person's life.
Absolutely.
The critical thing is balance, objectivity, and being involved in respectful relationships. If you look at the relationships people have generally, they are the most important indicators, and I would suggest that our schools today are not focused enough on respectful relationships. They're still fairly pragmatic places where teachers are the controlling factor. We don't join or try and embrace children in their learning enough, and there's certainly not enough people around the place who are capable of demonstrating those sorts of respectful relationships. And we still haven't got an answer from a government anywhere in the country with a determined policy to reattract men back into education.
So you think we need the five R's: reading, writing, arithmetic, and respectful relationships.
Absolutely.
We'll put that in the Ray Lenton curriculum for the future.
That's it.
Yeah.
So that's my view, folks. That's the way I feel about it. I think there's a lot we could do in school grounds, and it's not just about what it is that we're shoving into our kids' minds.
No. Well, I think that's where the failure, you know, okay, the family is where it starts, but then in the school, it's like the continuation of the failure. The failure Absolutely. Starts in the family, Absolutely. And then if it continues through the school, and the school, you would think if the family is failing, the school needs to be able to stop the failure, not continue it.
That's right, and engage parents.
Yeah.
You know, and I know it's difficult, but if we want a good society, a harmonious society, it's something that we just must do. We just must do.
Well, look, Ray, we've talked and talked and talked. I don't know what you and I managed to talk about for an hour and a half, but we've just about done it, mate. The theme music's on in the background and...
nonsense.
That's just about it for another week, mate. If you want to hear all this nonsense again, you can go to dadsontheair.net and listen to me and Ray speaking again.
About nonsense. Talking.
Well, I don't think it was all nonsense. I mean, I think you made a couple of good points, Ray.
Thank you.
I spoke nonsense. I always do. But yeah. I thought you made a couple of good points.
Thank you. And you too.
And we'll be back with more nonsense and more good points next week. Stay tuned. We've
Bye, got folks.
Country Bob coming on for Country On. He'll be on next. So stay tuned.
And we'll be kind to each other.
We're here because we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.